Is that enough, Jenny?
That was just beautiful, Bob.
Well, thank you, Greg. Where is Jenny?
She's right here.
Yeah, it was perfect, Bob. It was perfect.
You were listening through your computer?
On the phone.
We're on the house phones.
Yeah, but that's a little staticky.
I know, but we've already listened to it 4,000 times in the last 24 hours because we watched the Live Aid concert when we got home from the movie last night, and then we watched it again at a friend's house tonight because we went over there for dinner, and they had seen the movie last night, too, and they were hyped as F. So they
Is
watched
this a new
it
movie?
Too.
What's this all about? A new movie?
Well, they brought out... I guess you could say it's the life of Freddie Mercury. They're calling it Bohemian Rhapsody. But yeah. It's very important to note that the producers, co-producers of the movie, was the actual drummer and lead guitarist of Queen itself. So you've got to believe that there's a little bit of historical accuracy in these people, you know, honoring, you know, their best buddy for years and years and years in the band, Freddie. We all got to acknowledge that Ion was a pretty big Queen fan, right? I mean, it wasn't just me. Ion enjoyed Queen. And after watching this movie, I have such a better understanding of what Ion was trying to point at in their music. You know, Bohemian Rhapsody, the song itself, was pretty much ahead of its time in the kind of recording they did and the different soundtracks they mixed. You know, this movie, I won't give any of it away, but Freddie is really portrayed as a musical genius coming from a position of power rather than authority. And, you know, he goes to, you know, wanting to record records with opera in it in the age of rock and roll. And, I mean, how many, you know, how many recording studios would have gone for that at the time? You know, it was all like, no, you can't
well,
do
you know,
that.
Well, you know, Zappa did that. Zappa did it.
There's no doubt that Zappa laid the groundwork. There was no reference in the movie that Freddie had listened to any Zappa, but it was very Zappa-ish in what he was doing.
So this was a docudrama or a documentary?
No, full-blown, good-time, happy movie about Queen.
It's a Hollywood production, Bob. It's not a docudrama.
Well, is it fiction or what is it? What's a Hollywood production?
No, it's not nonfiction. It is the story of Queen. It's the story of Queen,
who
the band.
Who played Freddie?
And, a guy, I'll
Mr.
tell you what
Robot.
His name is.
Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot. There you go, Carolyn. Yeah, Mr. Robot plays Freddie.
What, that kid?
Yeah.
The kid who
yeah.
looks like somebody. He played Freddie Queen?
Yep.
Yes,
Rami
he did.
Rami Malek.
Right, right, right.
Rami Malek.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if he won an Oscar.
Absolutely. No, he didn't just play Freddie. He channeled Freddie.
Yeah, totally.
Because when you look at this guy in the movie performing and then go and watch Live Aid, go and watch any concert of Queen, and look at the two silhouettes, you're going, oh, my God. He is Freddie. It is that incredible how he captured him. Everything. His movements, his hand gestures, his fist pumping, his facial expression, his body is exactly the same as Freddie Mercury was. Bob, it was incredibly impressive. I haven't seen a movie like this in years.
And this, the kid, Mr. Robot Kid, he grew his hair long?
Go ahead, honey. He throughout the movie, of course, Freddie's growing up. So they dressed him. They gave him the mustache at the time of his life when he had a mustache. You know, Freddie Mercury had buck teeth, of course. For the actor, he had to wear some kind of prosthetic in his mouth to make him look the same.
They covered him all through his life. And this kid did every phase.
Did every phase, yeah, from the very beginning of when he first started as a singer. But the point that I was making was that Ion loved, you know, the Queen and what they were doing. And since I've seen that movie, the music that we've listened to of Queen has taken on a completely different meaning. It was, it's silly, but what they did to recreate, you know, someone's persona on the movie screen, as Virginia said, I have no doubt he could be winning an Oscar for the best actor, because you have to remind yourself this guy is not Freddie Mercury. He is an actor. He's Egyptian, so he did have the, you know, the skin tone and the hair that would be very similar to what Freddie Mercury was. He was some Azerbaijan weird country that I'd never heard of before in real life. And he
where did he grow up?
Was it New York?
Brooklyn? Long Island?
You're on mute. Honey, you're on mute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
Where did he grow up?
Sorry. Oh, hold on.
Long Island?
England.
No.
Long Island.
No, I think the band originally started in
What did Ginny say? What's Ginny saying? She's on mute still.
She's bouncing all off her computer.
He is a British singer, Bob. He was born in the town of Stone Town, Sultanate of Zanzibar, which is now Tanzania. But he was, since age 5 or something, lived in Kensington, London.
The band was formed there?
The band was formed in London, 100%. I mean, they're a British band. That's why they set the world on fire with Live Aid. But, yeah, they're a British band.
And he called it Queen because he believed he was royalty, or he believed his persona was royalty. So it wasn't Queen as in we're all gay. Freddie Mercury was portrayed in the movie as bisexual. But they chose the name Queen because of what he thought was the regalness of the royal family. Pretty interesting and pretty ionic.
Yeah, of his royal family or the Queen Elizabeth?
Queen Elizabeth. He loved Queen Elizabeth.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's why I...
Hey, Bob, where was I during... the trending of Queen, I don't really...
Yeah, we weren't listening to music radio. Was that in the late 70s?
The main album, which featured Bohemian Rhapsody, which was the Night at the Opera, came out in 1974. And Freddie Mercury died in 1991. So that was their quote-unquote reign during that time, 74 to 91.
Well, say Carolyn goes into med school in 74. She's gone for 5 years. She's gone for 5 years. She doesn't exist. Yeah. And I didn't listen to radio much, but I heard them somewhere, but never liked them that much. They were just too mainstream emotion, too bellowing, something like that. And but eventually, did they do We Are the Champions?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I got to know them later, in occasional Super Bowl or something. You know, that would be the people would sing that, right? What I heard about.
Yeah, no, that's a good analogy. That was adapted in many, many sports arenas. We Are the Champions, absolutely.
Yeah, when I was thinking about after you requested last night, I was thinking he and many of those bands in the 70s, they had a bigger audience than the Beatles. Because there weren't that many people in the world, I guess, or the rock industry hadn't spread. So, you know, the Beatles is a really big deal, but many people in the 70s, 80s, younger people, never heard of them because Queen and them had bigger audiences probably. Madonna probably had a huge, bigger audience population-wise. You know, just think of that. The Beatles are, for older people, are legends, but... there's this famous rock critic who was in a record store in the 70s, and these young girls were looking at albums, and they were looking at Wings, and they said, oh, Paul McCartney was in a band before Wings called the Beatles. They didn't even know.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Okay.
That's pretty funny.
So But I was thinking how the what is huge fame? You know, Billie Holiday was big, but she probably had one-tenth the size of the Beatles. The Beatles had one-tenth of Queen. Queen had one-tenth of Madonna. And who's next? Prince? Gaga or Prince? Oh, is Lady Gaga naming herself after Radio Gaga?
I thought that myself. I thought, where did she get that handle from? I'm wondering if she was a bit of a Queen fan. Yeah, I thought the exact same thing.
Was she putting down, no, was Queen putting down mainstream radio with Radio Gaga? All we get is Radio Gaga?
I think they had their issues with the mainstream record companies, who, of course, told them things like, well, you can't have a six-minute song because they won't play on the radio. And, you know, Queen's position was, yes, they will, because we're Queen. Not coming from a position of authority, but coming from a position of power, knowing what their destiny was. I mean, they did the Live Aid concert, and according to statistics and the movie itself, people really didn't start donating heavily until Queen came on. And, Virginia, what was the thing you said about the 21 minutes that they played on Live Aid? It was rated as one of the best and most...
Well, I mean, the 24 minutes that they were on Live Aid was the most profitable time of the concert, and also it has been ranked the most prolific rock performance, live rock performance ever, ever in the history
prolific?
Of any.
What does that mean? Wait, prolific?
Well, it means it was far-ranging, Bob, far-ranging, 24 minutes.
No, what's the word prolific mean? Did she made a lot of money, Carolyn.
No. I said that in a separate sentence. What I said was they were on for the time that they were there with Live Aid, they made the most money. But I'm saying as far as rock critics are concerned, the 24 minutes that they played at Live Aid is considered the most prolific live rock performance of any rock performer ever.
Well, they only played 20 minutes, so how's that prolific?
Well, it was a Wimbledon Stadium. This, of course, was Bob Geldof's hard-on to raise all this money.
July 85, we referred to it in our Perfect Pitch newsletter.
Bob, are you just put off because we're not talking about Zappa here?
No, I'm just curious about what you're saying.
Okay, I'm just wondering. Well, what I'm saying is that for 24 minutes, they were actually able to show the full depth and scope of their creativity, and they were able to hold the audience's attention in such a way, 100,000 people, that most rock bands would never even come close to being able to accomplish. So I'm
just
saying.
Did other bands play as long on Live Aid?
Oh, my God,
yes,
they were all given the same amount of time.
They were all given 21 minutes.
Yes. They were all given the same time.
So when I stopped the recording, was there more to be heard of the 3 or 4 minutes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So they were considered prolific compared to the other bands in Live Aid.
Absolutely. Well,
I mean, Phil Collins was a big thing back then. He obviously had a good audience. But I think what they were showing is that Freddie Mercury and his band could involve, you know, 70,000 people at Wimbledon Stadium into their music so much that, you know, they were stomping and it was, you know, creating seismic rifts that they could measure, you know, around the world because people were watching this. I think, what was the number of people we read that watched Live Aid? It was something like 15 million people around the world watched this concert. And once Queen had finished their set, the amount of call-in donations to Live Aid just went ballistic. It was clearly they were inspired, not by Queen saying, oh, give money, because they never said that, but the music made them generous. So they were the ones who kicked off Live Aid and the money started flowing in after that.
How soon in the 24-hour cycle or whatever did they come on? Were they in the first third?
They came in. The Live Aid started at noon, and they came in at 6:41 p.m., and then they came back on at 11:30 that night. So it had been 6.5 hours that they had been going on with the concert with very little monetary contribution, and then Queen came on and everybody finally decided to kick it in, and in that 24 minutes they raised £1 million, which is more than they had raised the whole day.
Right. Did other bands get to play twice like they did?
Well, I think they were invited back for an encore. I don't know that, Bob. I don't know all the details of the concert.
Yeah.
I'm just saying as it relates to Queen. But the thing, the reason why Greg and I are on the show tonight talking to you, Bob, is because I think you would enjoy this this video, and I think you would enjoy having the experience of watching who Freddie Mercury is in light of how much you have prattled on incessantly about Frank Zappa all these years, that the way that Freddie Mercury creates his music and the way the band worked and their relationship with each other was totally very unique, and I would be interested. Now, Bob, I have a trivia question for you. Can
Hold
you
on.
Tell me what?
I want to talk about one more thing about what was ironic about the band Queen and Freddie. And Ian has always talked about contrast and heat and the fire and not having any heat with the fire. And it was interesting because Freddie, had broken up with Queen at some point, obviously, and gone to try to do his own thing, and it didn't work. And when they asked Freddie why didn't it work, he said, because everybody did what I said. And he missed the band poking at each other, arguing about this, arguing about that. Contrast, which that contrast is what created their creation of great music. Not, four band members all going, oh, yeah, that's all beautiful, let's all do the same thing. They were always pushing at each other, always pushing back at each other, always giving each other grief. And from that contrast came great musical creations. That's very ironic. Go ahead, honey.
Okay, so Dave Neufeld's here. I guess he just couldn't hold back. This is Dave's world. What do you have to say, Dave?
It's really interesting listening to it. Sorry, I just got over a cold. No, it's interesting to hear also what Greg's saying now and about the taking of the power. I think what they're saying about that performance at the Live Aid, Bob, is you'd have to see it. Basically, a lot of people in Britain especially, they already knew Queen, and they had a lot of huge hits on the radio already, and obviously Bohemian Rhapsody was huge. But when they came out at that concert, I haven't seen the footage for a long time, but I remember thinking that too. He's a consummate front man, that guy. He basically can get 100,000 people simultaneously doing calisthenics or whatever he wants, and they're loving it every minute. No one even feels inhibited. It's incredible how he just brings the whole audience. You know, it may as well be a tiny room, but it's 100,000 people. So you should see that footage. I'm sure it's somewhere on YouTube or whatever. And then you can see, the guy's a rock star.
So Dave. Hi, honey. Hi, Dave.
Hey,
wait
buddy.
A minute, Bob.
Yeah.
Hi, buddy.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave. Listen, did you know that when they came out and they did that Live Aid concert, that he already knew he was HIV positive? And he was struggling with his voice. He could not sing.
Really? Wow, because that's 85. So that's pretty early in the AIDS sort of thing started in like 79, 80, the first cases. So he would also have gotten, theoretically, a much more virulent version of HIV than if he was infected that early.
Yes. Yep. So 85, he came on stage. He was diagnosed in May. He was starting to lose his voice, and he was concerned about whether or not he could. He begged the band to get back together so he could go do that concert because he wanted it to be his thing. And, he could not sing. And it's just incredible to see the amount of power he pushes through his body in light of the fact that he knew that he had AIDS and he was sick at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was awesome.
Having AIDS was a death sentence.
Exactly.
That,
pretty much.
ACT or whatever the hell that horribly toxic drug was that hopefully killed the AIDS before.
Well, Carolyn could have dealt with it even then, and she was shortly after that, actually, in that sense. But for sure, and all they would have had is a crap like that. But also the whole sense that if it's a genetically created virus, or something grafted onto a bovine Visna virus or something. I forget the exact thing, but whatever. Carolyn had interviewed people around that time, you know, doctors that had said, you know, it looks like it's genetically modified. It's like an animal virus that's been tweaked to cross over into humans. But I think it was the Evergreens that said that the virus, yeah, was genetically modified, but also it was designed to lose its virulence, which is odd how you could program it into it, but to become less virulent as time went on so that, you know, in this era now, people, the Evergreens had said, you know, in the mid-'80s that people would say, oh, I had AIDS on the weekend, like you had the flu.
That'd be 29 years later. That would be 29 years later. It was called a viral debilitant, and it was originally designed to mutate and become benign, say, within 2 weeks so that you could go in and take over the country after all the citizens had been weakened. That was the plan.
Well, the Evergreens told me about that was, you know, all of these design drugs were never designed to kill people. Because it's clearly understood in warfare, if you have one person sick, it takes five to take care of them. Now, they designed it so that people would get sick and not die, because if they die, nobody's taking care of them. They want the people sick, tie up more of the resources, and as you said, it got so virulent that they died, which was not.
Well, also don't forget too, there's also the whole African side of it, with where it's administered potentially to the whole population, and then whether or not it's deliberately done, the fact is that all across the Central Africans, I remember reading the Globe and Mail in the 90s, basically it said it gutted their economies because it basically wiped out all, you know, a huge section of the males from 18 to 35, so you don't have a military, a police, all the shit you kind of need to have a stable nation, too. So basically, as far as like just destroying the economy, it kind of relates to what you're saying, is tying up their resources and illness and that. And yeah. But I did see Queen in 1978. It was their a Day at the Races tour. That was their follow up album to the Night at the Opera one. And the hit off that was Somebody to Love. You guys remember that song at the time? Ginny, you would have remembered that, eh? Somebody to Love,
yeah,
by Queen?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Absolutely, I need somebody. Yeah, absolutely.
And the thing is, truly talented, too, because he, at that gig, I saw it at Maple Leaf Gardens, and the backup band was Thin Lizzy, and they were fantastic, too. You know, another great British band with great tunes, and obviously their hit, Boys Are Back in Town, is like a, you know, a classic. And Freddie Mercury, the whole gig, he was on the baby grand piano. You could also see, like, you know, so talented, like a great pianist, you know, and those songs were like, you know, Elton Johnny kind of level, you know, or like, you know, it's not just basic boogie-woogie chords, you know, they're involved stuff that he really knew what he was doing, playing, and he's singing. So that's what we realized, too. They weren't faking it, but when they did Bohemian Rhapsody, they actually, the whole opera part in the middle, they were filled on. They actually did. They started the song live, and then they went to that, and they basically, yeah, just went, walked off the stage and played the tape, like, of the that section. And then they go back to the dressing room, have a drink, or whatever they do back then. And when it comes back to the do-do-do-do-do, that's when the band comes on stage. And, of course, everyone
that's
does a standing
brilliant.
Ovation.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And nobody
really
cared. And nobody cared.
Nobody cared because they knew how the hell the band's going to do it live. They're not even going to put a pretense that they are. And they use that little section to go back to the dressing room and have a drink and a little break. And then they come back on. And, of course, people would cheer and they put on a bunch of, you know, the lights showing explosions. They, you know, really pump it up in that section. And people would start freaking out. Yeah, they were great, Bob. And also don't forget, too, that whole disco thing that they did was such a shift because when I first encountered Queen, my brother was really into them, and he really liked their first three albums. And their first three albums, besides really kind of showing off how great, you know, Freddie Mercury is as a performer and singer, is the guitar player, Brian May, too. You know, it's like he was like a heavy metal, you know, dream for anyone that liked Led Zeppelin or Deep Purple or any of these bands. Loved Queen too because they had, you know, fantastic guitar solos and it was very guitar oriented music.
Yeah.
Off of the Sheer Heart Attack album, Brighton Rock is great and he uses all this amazing delay on guitar. So yeah, they were amazingly talented. And then that disco thing, I remember that just, I think that's in 79, another one Bites the Dust. I mean, you know, at weddings, how many, when they did the, like, the garter belt toss, you know, that little ritual in weddings? Yeah, that, often we would play another one, Bites the Dust. Yeah, but anyways, no, it was awesome, and that was so different. And I remember that took over radio, you know. You'd hear that out of every, you know, Italian guy's Camaro in 1979, you know. It just, like, took over. It's incredible. And then actually, people, that almost gave them a bit of a problem because it had a conflict that they couldn't become a full-on disco band like the Bee Gees or something, even though they were effective at it, because it alienated a lot of their rock audience from the first five albums. So that was a little bit of a conundrum they ran into, too. And you saw that in that period in the early 80s. They do gigs where they get a better response on the rock songs, and then they, oh, here's something from a new album, and it was more of a disco-y kind of synthesizer kind of song, and it would not get the same kind of response. But of course, another one, Bites the Dust, is just murderous. And I remember, of course, Daft Punk took that beat and had their, what was that, their first big track was basically the groove off Another One Bites the Dust. So yeah, man, Queen definitely have made a great contribution, a great song catalog, and Freddie Mercury truly is an awesome performer. I mean, that's just a given. And I haven't seen that movie, but, you know, it's really funny. It got panned by the critics, a lot of the critics. I looked at average Metacritic score, 46%. But check this out. Average viewer score, just like the regular Joe Blows who don't review movies for a living, something like 8.5 out of 10. Like, most of them gave it 10 out of 10. They said, don't worry about the fucking reviewers. Who cares if it's not complete? Accurate, for fuck's sake. And they all say, like, Freddie Mercury is awesome. I'm like, holy shit, man, this movie's fucking great. So that's an interesting thing, too, that the critics don't like it, but everyone else is responding like Ginny and Greg are.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing about the hardcore critics of Queen and all their big fan bases, nobody called to ask them to consult on the movie, because it's like, oh, Freddie didn't have a mustache in 1980 when Another One Bites the Dust was recorded. It's like, who the fuck cares?
No, Peggy. Yeah.
Right? You know, they're missing the point. So there's that little fan weirdness that goes on where everybody has to be superior in their knowledge. It's like it's some kind of an ownership position of...
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The old Gutenberg effect. The old Gutenberg after image.
Yeah.
There you go, the Gutenberg effect. But yeah, it was after really image. Extraordinary. And I just thought, you know, to be an individual person and to be able to pull down that kind of energy and inspiration, and to be able to channel it and then spin it right back out and throw it out into an audience, all the albums, everything that they did.
Yeah.
I always admired Queen. I always, you know, I had the music when I was young. We grew up on Queen. I mean, 74 to 79, I was in junior high and high school.
Mm-hmm.
All those songs were my time of life. But I never really thought about, quote-unquote, Freddie Mercury, like who he was as a creative, you know, until I saw this movie. And when I saw this movie, I was like, this guy was so plugged in. It was amazing.
I don't. But then can't you glean that from then, in retrospect, from his catalog? Do you think that, like, Death on Two Legs, his, like, song to his manager that they finally got rid of, you know, that he's like a creative genius and a great lyricist and a great musician, obviously, you know, a real, like I say, when I saw him live, he played piano the whole gig. So he sung and played piano. I occasionally get up and do the mic, but a real musical talent as well, and a great writing talent. You know, I actually recorded at Rockfield where Queen did Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's a very humble studio. A lot of albums have been done there. Oasis did their big albums there as well. But that it's a very humble studio. Like, it's a very basic room, and that, you know, and they had their tape deck. And I remember someone had said that they went and the Queen sessions were boring because you go to see Queen recording and they just spend 3-4 hours on, you know, some organ sounds or something like that. So you, like, couldn't, like, really gauge, like, what progress they're making. They're like, it was a real studio band as well, you know what I mean? A lot of overdubbing, a lot of takes, shit as well. That, and also just when you see the studio where they recorded those albums, it's just basically a humble, like, 10 by 10 foot ceiling height, 14 foot width.
And they show that in the movie. They do.
Do they good? Yeah,
the
yeah.
Movie. They go.
I know Black Sabbath recorded there. All kinds.
Farmhouse.
Yes, exactly.
In a farm, in a barn.
It was, well, you know, it was owned by the Rolls-Royce family, and they exactly have part of it, and there's a horse farm there. Yes, it's owned by this guy Kingsley. I mean, it's, so many people have recorded there. It's absurd. It's a bizarre. But the thing with that place, you go in there and record, and you're mixing, it's like, it's a very small, humble studio, and you're thinking it has so much cachet that you're sitting there working and mixing and recording where Queen and Black Sabbath and all these huge, really important recordings have been done. I mean, they were the first independent studio. He opened it about 1965 there, and funny, when he first started, it was like just one gigantic room because he figured, you know, to make big records, you need huge reverb, and they quickly discovered, no, actually you need dry, tight sounds and add reverb just on certain things kind of thing. So they quickly roomed it off. And then they had a reverb room there, their echo chamber, and it's funny, he showed it to me, and it was like what you sort of imagine. It's basically a room, and they had like put like the paint had like a varnish, so it was like mega reflective. And they had some mics in there, and then speakers. And then basically, you know, you would pipe your music from the studio into the speakers, and then it would come back with a beautiful thick sort of reverb. And they also had a nice plate reverb there. And to kind of fool people, when you went into the place, they had these two oil tanks in the front, and they, like, spray paint on one 8 seconds or something, and on the other one 3 seconds, you know, on the smaller one, to make you think that's how they're getting their reverb, you know?
That's really cute you say that, because that's exactly what's portrayed in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Right down to the dime. Right down to the dime.
Yeah. Well, I spent like, I worked with the Super Furry Animals there, and so I was mixing there for, and stayed over there about 10 or 12, it was about a good 10 days or something. And then when I did Los Campesinos too, and one of their EPs there, we recorded a bunch of shit there. And so that was about a 4-day session. So I've been there a couple of times on two different sessions. And yeah, it's a guy named Kingsley. You can imagine the stories that he has. It's just, I'll tell you one quick story. It's fucking incredible. He was one of the first guys that recorded there was Dave Edmonds. Remember that thing? No, the first hit that they had. So it took them actually 4 years before they had a hit. They opened the studio in 65, but their first significant hit was, you remember this song in 1969 when, Bob, you'll remember this one, the one, I hear you knocking. It was that Dave Edmonds had done it. But you can't come in. Or, I can't quite remember it enough, but you remember it was called I Hear You Knocking. There was a song on the radio around that era. Maybe you guys don't remember it. You're too young.
No, but, I remember it. I know what you're talking
about.
Okay.
I remember it.
Yeah, so that was the first, and then he had a band called Love Sculpture, and they did a kick-ass version of the Saber Dance. And then that's where it started opening up. But basically, he said, so he stayed friends for a long time, you know, they're in Wales, with Dave Edmonds, and he said, he's also friends with Robert Plant, and Joe Strummer did his solo stuff there. And Joe Strummer, and so he was there, and one day he had a day off, Joe Strummer from the session, and so Robert Plant, the singer of Led Zeppelin, and Dave Edmonds, their pals, they just came over to hang, and so Kingsley had said to Robert Plant and Dave Edmonds, hey, Joe Strummer's the guy in the Clash is recording his album here right now. Want to meet him? And they're like, yeah, sure. So he calls up Joe Strummer and says, hey, I'm here at the farm with Robert Plant and Dave Edmonds, and they want to know if you'd like to come over for some tea. And so Joe Strummer's like, okay, sure. So he comes over and meets Robert Plant for the first time, and Robert Plant says, Robert Plant says, wow, this part I might have wrong, but either one way or the other, is either Robert Plant goes, hey, I'm pleased to meet you, and Joe Strummer goes, hey, it's an honor to meet you. Because it's funny, because don't forget, Joe Strummer represented the whole punk strain that kind of was a rebellion against bands like Led Zeppelin, who seemed like, you know, posh, rich, you know, corporate, giant acts, mega acts that, you know, didn't have human scale by that point. So they kind of represented almost two traditions in a sense, you know. Joe Strummer didn't represent super rock stardom kind of thing. But anyways, they really got on, and but the crazy thing that happened was he wasn't gonna record to come back till that Monday, Joe Strummer. So he met Robert Plant, they hung out, that was really nice, and then he leaves, and Kingsley says, hey, Joe, can you give me a studio check for some studio time? I don't think we've gotten anything in yet. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay, for sure. I'll send in a check today. So that was like on Thursday or Friday. And then on Saturday, he died of a heart attack, Joe Strummer. And Kingsley says, you know, I was like, holy shit. He goes, and I felt really guilty because I also thought, oh, shit, I'm not going to get paid for the studio time. And he felt guilty for thinking that. And he said, the crazy thing is on, I think, the Tuesday or Wednesday, he got the check in the mail. And on the check, it said, here you go, Kingsley, and I can't wait to see you on Monday and record more.
Oh, wow.
Wow. One little ditty from this movie, of course, Bohemian Rhapsody got, quote, re-released through Wayne's World, right? They're all
the like rejuvenated, you mean? Like re-sort of picked up in the public consciousness or sort of or re-released as a single?
Well, rejuvenated in the consciousness of the people through Wayne's World.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who gets a cameo appearance in this movie?
Mike Myers.
Bingo.
So what did he do in the movie? Though? What does he play? It's not
great.
See, I can tell you. I don't
right, right. That's a spoiler, right?
Attention, because
that's a spoiler. Oh, it's a cameo, so it's not like if you need to make up.
Slow down. I can't even hear what Greg's saying. Mike Myers did. What did Mike Myers do, Greg?
In Wayne's World, they had a very famous scene where the Bohemian Rhapsody, and they're driving in a car, basically brought the song back to the consciousness of people because it had been forgotten. And so I believe that the drummer and the guitar player, who were the co-producers of the movie, gave him a cameo appearance in the movie as a thank you for them, for, you know, Wayne's World reintroducing Bohemian Rhapsody to the public.
So you have to just look for him, Carolyn. You have to look for him. He's got a cameo role in the life of the band in a very specific scene, and you'll see him there if you look for him.
Okay. So you can't give it away and tell me what exactly he did.
Yeah, you don't want to.
You'll see it. You'll figure it out.
You'll see it. But another thing I want to say, Bob, is that just I thought...
Can I say something, Ginny? Just a second, Ginny.
Yes, yes.
You couldn't get a better commentary than Dave.
Oh, outstanding. Thank you.
Well, you could have my commentary, Bob.
No. Dave can tell you about the
Dave.
Studio. He was at the goddamn studio for fuck's sake. That was dramatized.
I'm just busting your... Yes, Bob, of course. Dave has some very valuable contribution.
No, the studio he's talking about is in the movie.
Yeah, Bob, it's in the
movie. Yeah. And Dave was there, worked there. Dave had a bigger audience than Queen ever did. And I'm going to ask Dave.
No, not that.
No,
but that,
Bob,
thanks
I
for the hype,
that.
Bob.
Wait a minute, Dave.
Thanks
a lie
for
is
the hype,
hasn't
Bob.
Happened yet. Now listen to this. When we have live Bob, you watch. When we have live Bob, I can do what he did with 5 billion people, right? I'll get 5 billion people chanting, Frank Zappa, Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa. No, Bob, I hope not. They'll probably be chanting Ginny Almighty, and by then
Dave and I will have
done our legendary album together.
Yay!
Hi,
Dave.
Yes, but Carol is doing a drum.
Bob, why did you play the Queen now? Now I'm thinking, what is it a coincidence that you put on a bunch of Queen songs in your set?
No, I never play Queen. I had the I was ordered to play it last night. So you know, Ginny, I work for Ginny, so I had to do it. So. I noticed Ginny was on the line, and then she went away. And I said, what the fuck? What am I going to do? So I said, well, I'll just play it at the very end or tell her I'm going to play it. So I played Live Aid, which I got it in there. No, I saw that I had it in my inventory. And while I was playing other songs, I came across it way in the middle of the 1,000 songs. Oh, there's Queen, you know, Live Aid, but I wouldn't be able to find it. So I bring it in. It's at the bottom of the list because it's the latest. Yeah. And I don't know what it is. I remember playing the beginning of it once, just the crowd, them revving up the crowd. But I didn't know it went on for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So I said, well, this is good. This is a whole bunch of Queen that Ginny wanted. So it was all serendipitous. And then
I
went to you to get the details. Nobody gave the details like Dave just did about we always get the best commentary.
Yes, Dave did a very – thank you, Dave, for coming on and contributing. Now, Bob, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you know the three songs that Ion repeatedly used in the first 2 years of Queen.
The when would he play these? When would I am play these?
One, he would play them on Tailgate. Two, he would play them on, he played them, remember the first Rogue Ion one-on-one, 101? Remember the first Rogue Ion? He played him on all three of those Ion sessions, and he named one of Sheila's paintings after that song.
So you want me to name the three songs that he played?
I do.
I have no idea. I don't, I'm not into Queen.
So that would be my contribution here. I'm going to tell you what they are.
All right.
The first one is Princes of the Universe. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Born to be King, We Are Princes of the Universe. Those are the, it was the soundtrack to Highlander.
I watched Highlander, but I didn't notice any music. They were too corny for me, too mainstream. So I don't know that song. Didn't register.
Okay. Okay,
next
so
one.
Born to be King, Princess of the Universe, and of course that Born to be King painting is the one that Sheila did for Greg. Then the second one is the Prophet Song. Do you know that one?
Nope.
The Prophet Song is an...
In those early years, I said, this is damn fucking what J.W. grew up with. This is J.W. fucking me. I had choices.
Yeah.
Fucking lousy.
His musical prime influences.
Yeah. You know, he's born in 65, so, you know, J.W., he was a bit precocious, so 10, 11, 12, 13.
Sure, those bands are huge at that point.
When his anthem.
Yeah, of course.
His anthem. When were you born, Ginny? 61? Same as Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are the same age. So you're a little older. But anyways, that early music that Ion played, I hate it. Because it was right when we tuned out. I was becoming an expert on oldies at that point. It was all so bad. I went back to my roots.
Were those Queen songs that you said that Ion was referring to? Okay, I've never heard of them. So they were probably, Ion was picking them for the lyrics more than they were.
Yeah, the lyrics,
Queen,
Bob. It did not have anything to do. Yeah, it was the lyrics.
They had,
the princes of the universe. Born to be kings, we are princes of the universe. We're immortal, we have the blood of kings. Ion was
well, I didn't need that propaganda. You know, I already knew that about myself. So I didn't respond to the mainstream.
Bob thought, these are Hallmark cards. These are, you're like, you know, soar with the eagles. I don't need those posters in my office.
That's right. I preferred satire. I wanted to put the poster Zappa to him in hell where he's dressed like Hell's Angels. And now we're talking. Zappa.
Now, I want you to, after we get off the show tonight, I want you to hang up the phone and get on your voluminous archive and search for all the places that you and Ion argued about who was superior, Freddie Mercury or Frank Zappa.
I don't remember that. Did he actually talk about Freddie Mercury?
It's got to be in there somewhere.
I don't recall that. He never talked about these people. He never talked about these people.
Oh, no, because... Yeah, I do.
He would promote Freddie Mercury. I never heard him promoting anybody against Zappa. He just said Zappa was shit, and then he would go into his crap.
That would be promoting everybody against Zappa, Bob, just in case. But that would be. But no, I remember specifically one night on the tailgate with the Prophet Song and Queen and Zappa. Yeah, so look for
that. Well, that was the dumb propaganda for Tina and Pam Wall. You know, they needed it bad, so he would just ram it down their ears. And I'd go have a sandwich, you know, and that stuff was on.
Yes, that's true. So anyway, that's the scoop, Bob. That's what we wanted to share with you.
Well, I got a couple questions. You guys said you watched Live Aid, the whole thing, or something on YouTube, or just the Queen part of Live Aid after the movie?
Well, we watched the Live Aid part after the movie because we wanted to see, you know, Greg watched Live Aid. We didn't really remember the whole Queen segment, and we just wanted to see, you know, like how tough was
it. Okay, but you're not answering my question. You watched the Queen segment of Live Aid.
Yes, we watched the Queen segment.
After watching it depicted in the film?
It's a separate thing on YouTube. You can get the different bands. Yeah, I see. So you watched it several times. Your friends watched it. And you had both seen the movie, which had just come out.
Yes.
Yeah, and was it depicted in the movie? That concert?
If you watch, Dave, if you watch the movie,
showing the Live Aid concert and then stop the movie and go to the real Live Aid
concert. Yeah.
Dude.
It looks the same.
Fucking unbelievable. I mean,
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And we read a little bit about the actor. The very first thing that they did in filming of this movie was the Live Aid concert. So he
really?
Had to get on stage right out of the shoot and be Freddie at the Live Aid concert.
Why? Because the logistics of shooting the film with depicting a large audience?
They just, no reason.
Really? That was the first scene?
First thing they shot. And this
shot, not the first scene of the movie, but yeah.
Maybe they wanted to inspire the cast. You know, that was the peak point, sort of.
Yeah.
So they wanted to inspire the cast
with
that.
Good point, Bob. Yes, exactly. Let's go for the hardest thing to do, and after that, it's a piece of cake.
Yeah, it's going to triumph.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought was really interesting, Dave, was I saw the actor talking about preparing to be Freddie Mercury, and he had this obviously large prosthetic that was built for his mouth to, you know, deform his mouth to be similar to Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
And when he put it in, he became so self-conscious of this whole kind of what he considered to be a deformation of his mouth, that he immediately started to think about how can I, you know, hold my posture differently and be more regal and project myself differently to compensate for this mouth.
Huh.
And he said in that moment, he realized what Freddie Mercury was up against, this challenge of this whole mouth thing, and how he valued the mouth because of what it did for his sound, and yet that was the target that people were focusing on and not really seeing his talent beyond that, and it really helped humble him and prepare him to be this role. And his performance is amazing.
Yeah, I got to see it. It's playing at a local cinema. Actually, their triple bill right now is A Star Is Born with Lady Gaga, The Nutcracker Suite, and this Bohemian Rhapsody.
Wow.
Now, on the Metacritic, the Lady Gaga one got 88 out of the critics, and I didn't look at the user score, but I'm sure, I think that's been very well received as well.
It was
I'm pretty sure. What's that? The third movie's Nutcracker. Bohemian Rhapsody is the Queen one. And A Star Is Born is with Lady Gaga. And The Nutcracker Suite, I guess it's a remake of that famous film and soundtrack. Good old Tchaikovsky.
Yeah,
can't go wrong with that.
Yeah.
But,
well, Dave,